Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
2 months of accordion lessons once when I was a kid. That's all I had. Other than that, I was self-taught.
Everyone, and welcome to Rockin' the Suburbs. My name is Patrick Foster. On behalf of Jim Lanahan, I want to be the first to welcome you all to Beach Boys Week. That's right. This week, we will have a series of episodes on the Beach Boys. And as I'm sure most listeners know, Brian Wilson passed not too long ago, and we did spend a little time talking about Brian. We had some of our listeners contribute to that, and that was all very much appreciated. And this is an idea that had been floating around for a little bit, actually before Brian's sad passing. And Nick Scalera, member of our listenership and great friend of the show, had pointed out that when looking through the archives of Rockin' the Suburbs, he didn't come across very many episodes about the Beach Boys. There were mentions here and there, but never a deep dive, and he thought it would be appropriate at some point to do that. And even though it's a sad reason, when Brian did pass away, we felt like, hey, this is a great time to undertake some episodes on the Beach Boys. So Nick, being a Beach Boys head, and another good friend of the show, Mike Wagner, also a big Beach Boys head, they got together recently and worked off of an excellent outline that Nick prepared. He's excellent at this kind of research, and I know he loves doing it as well. And it totally reflects in the episodes they put together. And I'll be chiming in with a few comments at the beginning of the end of each of these episodes, and turned over the recordings to me, and I kind of put them all together and try to get them going in a good narrative way. And I think it came out really well, if I do say so myself. A big, big thanks to Nick and Mike. Thanks, guys. Now, the first episode that we're going to hear, start off the week with, is basically going to cover from essentially 1961 to 1963, going to some of the background on the Wilson family, the formation of the band, the kind of quote-unquote formula they came up with, and talk about their first national success with a kind of a homemade single. And then moving on to a record label where they would change the course of music history. So with all that said, I'm going to dive in, and you're going to hear Mike giving Nick the cue to sort of begin the history of the Beach Boys and the Wilson family. So let's take it away. Here we go. Episode 1 of Beach Boys Week.
Nick, if you would kindly go ahead and give us a little bit of background about the Wilson family, how the Beach Boys came to be, that sort of stuff.
Sure, sure. And, you know, I know that we have a lot of listeners who probably know bits and pieces of the Beach Boys story. I certainly have. What I've sort of noticed digging into this in a more thorough way is that it's wilder and crazier than even I imagine. But it does help. I think it helps to go through this context, understand where they came from, where the music came from, where they started, the family relationships. So we'll go through some of this. Some of this will be familiar. Some of this might not be, but I think it's super important. And to sort of kick off a wider discussion of the artistry here. There's been some discussion about this since Brian's death. I think for a lot of us of a certain age, there was a period where the Beach Boys were, in our younger years, were a nostalgia act, and they weren't cool. And it was this, suddenly there was this masterpiece that we were supposed to know about. And there's this sense that, like, the early stuff was just kind of like, it was just bubblegum surf music. There's nothing to it. And that's exactly not what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about, like, how the masterpiece, if you want to call Pet Sounds that, I think we would, that all the seeds of it, they sort of progressively happen over the, like, really only 3 or 4 years. It's all there. Like, the seeds of the later, genius is in the early stuff. So that's why we'll focus on that. But let's talk about the Wilson family. Wilson family, Brian was the oldest. Carl is the middle child, and Dennis was the youngest. They were raised in Hawthorne, California, which is a suburb in the south of Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's just south of Los Angeles.
It's kind of interesting. It's not super far from the beach, but it's not a beach community. Yeah, it was a working class neighborhood. It was not a particularly wealthy area, but it did have that sort of post-war kind of suburban vibe to it. Of course, a big part of our story will be the father, Murray Wilson, who was... Well, Mike, what do you think when you hear the word Murray Wilson? What first comes to mind?
I would have to bleep myself, and I'm too lazy. I don't want to have to get the bleeper.
Right.
Yeah.
Murray is an interesting story. I mean, it's always... The truth is probably a little bit more complex than what we come to know. Of course, most people know that Murray Wilson was himself a quote-unquote songwriter. He had ambitions to be a songwriter. He did write a song. I believe it was called Two Step Backstep.
Yeah, something like that.
The name of it. And it did get recorded, and I'm pretty sure Lawrence Welk played that song at one point or another, or at one point, you know.
Or he should have.
He should have. And so Murray was very proud of that. And in fact, he played it quite a lot in the household. But Murray was a domineering figure. He had a terrible childhood himself and a very vicious father himself, which might explain a little bit of it. He encouraged Brian's talents. It was very clear early on that Brian had musical talent. They were a musical family. There was a lot of music in the household. Audrey, their mother, played piano, and there was a lot of sort of group singing happening in the house. But Murray was, you know, also maybe a little jealous of the talent he saw in Brian early on, just a little bit. And he was, you know, there's no doubt he was verbally and physically abusive to all the sons. I mean, there are some terrible stories. Probably the most famous of which is at various times Brian, who is deaf in one ear, which makes the story all the more fascinating, has attributed that to a strike from Murray, and then at other times he hasn't. Regardless, all three brothers have stories of just pretty terrible abuse, by our standards for sure, from Murray. And it was a tough place to grow up. But early on, Brian was really ahead of his time. He claims, not always the most reliable narrator, but he claims that he first heard Rhapsody in Blue when he was like 2 years old, two or 3 years old. I mean, I'm sure he heard it when he was young, but he was very fascinated by that. That was one of the sort of cornerstones of his musical upbringing, and also more notably, a group called the Four Freshmen. What do you know about the Four Freshmen, Mike?
I only know them through, you know, going through Brian.
Right.
Right. I mean, it's not like the Four Freshmen or something I heard when I was a kid or something. But that sort of music, if you listen to any sample of the Four Freshmen, you'll hear straight away, you'll go like, ah, yeah, okay, this is where the complex harmonies come in.
There's a story told of a very gentle and the girl who wore his ring through the wintry snow. The world they knew was one, for their hearts were full of spring. As the days grew old and the nights passed into time.
So how did the Beach Boys become the Beach Boys? So Brian forms a band with Carl and Dennis, his brother, brings in Mike Love. Now, Mike Love is a first cousin. Mike Love lives right down the street. It is Audrey's sister's son. That's Mike Love. And they also have a friend, Al Jardine, who Brian had met in high school, and that forms a nucleus of the early Beach Boys. Not surprisingly, Murray becomes a manager. We'll hear much more about that as time goes on. And they were kind of in the garage, because the Wilson house had essentially a garage that was a music room, as I understand it.
Yeah.
Banging away, Brian had an early tape recorder. I mean, the Wilsons weren't wealthy, but they weren't poor either. Sure. And I mean, it was a solidly middle-class background family, and they had enough money for a grand piano, not a grand piano, but a piano and musical right. instruments and an early tape recorder, which not all folks had back then. So, you know, we're talking the early 60s here. So surfing happened as a theme because the boys were kind of in the garage practicing harmonies, trying out songs. But Dennis was the surfer. Okay, there's only one beach boy who ever surfed in any real way, and that was Dennis. And he came in essentially one day and said, "Hey, there's this a lot of lingo around surfing, hang ten and whatever, right. you know, and it's its own kind of subculture." I probably didn't use that word, but it might be cool for the subject of our songs. It might be cool for lyrics. That again, that's the birth of the Beach Boys surf music. Now it's worth mentioning, it wasn't as if surf music didn't exist. It was right. just very different.
As Bill Mulligan will attest to.
Right, right. I mean, the Dick Dale stuff, but it was instrumental music. It certainly didn't have vocal harmonies, and it was a certain sort of guitar sound with a lot of reverb. The Beach Boys went in a totally different direction. They put surf lyrics to Four Freshmen harmonies, very trebly guitars. Murray was always like, up the treble. Used to upset the boys, yeah, but that was the sound of the guitars.
Well, because
it
would cut through on the crappy stereos that they had in their cars of the day. You know, a lot of those songs from the 60s have the mid-range is really pushed. So
for sure.
It, you know,
but it was a distinctive part of the sound. And, you know, we talk about Murray as clearly often the villain, but he was very involved in this process. And, you know, he used to, Al used to complain that, and you could hear this in some of the early tapes, Murray saying, "Put the treble up, Al, treble up, Al." But that was kind of a distinctive sound. You could really hear that in the early recordings. The first single is literally called Surfin', and this becomes a surprise regional hit. It actually was being played on the radio, and the boys were sort of like in their car in Southern California and hearing this on the radio. It was from a small, like, indie label, I guess you would call it at the time. Cracks the national charts. I don't remember what number it was, but
42.
So we can...
I don't know. It's just 42.
No, I don't know if it was. I don't know if it was even that high. Maybe top 100, something like that. I don't know.
Surfing is the only life, the only way for me now. Surf, surf with me. Bob, dip, 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 Bob, dip, dip. I got up this morning, turned on my radio. I was checking out the surfing scene to see if I would go. And when the DJ tells me that the surfing is fine, that's when I know my baby and I will have a good time. Surfing is the only life, the only way for me now. Surf, surf with me. Bob, dip, 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 bob, dip, dip. From the early morning to the middle of the night, anytime the surf is up, the time is right. And when the surf is down to take its place, we'll do the surfer stomp. It's the latest dance craze. Surfing, bob, dip, 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 surf, bob, dip, 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 surf, bob, dip, dip, bob, bob, dip, 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 bob, bob, dip, dip, surf, bob, dip, 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 surf, bob, dip, dip. Surfing is the only life, the only way for me now.
On the strength of that, Murray again. Again, our sort of our black hat or villain in this story actually did something quite remarkable, which he managed to score a record deal with Capitol Records off of this one single, Surfin'. He just kind of busted down the door at the Capitol Tower and is like, "You got to give these guys a deal." And Capitol had never had a rock band ever.
Right.
You know, and think about how much we associate Capitol with rock music. I mean, obviously the Beatles were on Capitol, whole other story. But that was a pretty amazing,
yeah,
actually, he was able to do
really,
that.
Really, really is. It's like, there's part of this early story, like, man, how did that happen? How did they go from that to a record deal? I mean, they did have some success with that one song, but then it turned into, you know, a deal.
Yeah.
And giving him studio time, which is a thing back in the day, right?
Oh, for sure. And I mean, it is one of the sort of remarkable inflections in this story, and there will be many where you're like, how did this thing happen?
Yeah, like this, when I look back at the early bit, it's like, how did this happen?
Right.
Right.
Like,
how did
this... It really came out of nowhere. Yeah, it was a unique, sort of a unique formula. We'll talk about the formula of Beach Boys music. The fact that you have these three brothers and there is something in blood harmony is a term I've heard before.
Yeah, I mean,
that they
there
just
is.
Had
there
these
certainly is.
Natural
because they
harmonies.
Did it as they, you know, I mean, you know, the,
they did it at Christmas parties.
Yeah, and they, sing. You know, then they're driving somewhere and they're back in the back seat. Literally, Brian's like instructing them to do harmonies.
Right,
you know,
right. So. Yeah, I mean, but again, you know, you sort of add that to surf music. You put out one single, and on a small label, and suddenly you're on Capitol Records. The way things were, things that would never happen again. Like a guy like Murray, who was this working class guy, mostly had written a couple of songwriting credits. You know, had lost an eye in an industrial accident. You know, had a terrible upbringing. Was a domineering figure, but like when he literally bullied Capitol Records into giving his boys a deal. He just showed up and was like, you know, he would do this.
You got to get my boys.
Get my boys on there, you know. And they listened to him, he was notorious years later for just like showing up whenever at Capitol Records and just beating these guys down. So. You know,
it's probably said, just give him the deal to get him out of here.
Exactly.
It's probably
get him.
There's
out.
Probably more truth to that than there is anything else. Because like
that was his sort of mantra. I mean, you can hear him on tapes of the recordings. Saying, come on, boys, you got to fight for success. You got to fight for success. And that was, you know, he certainly lived by that.
Yeah.
You know?
No,
he sort of did what he had to do.
I think
that's true. I mean, he was an important piece. He was a piece of the formula. He was. I mean, and his usefulness declined as the years went on, as we'll talk about. And you know. Is he damaged his sons in a lot of ways that we'll talk about. But that sort of spirit of competitiveness and like working hard, like that was that was really in Brian's sort of psyche, like through his life, even in the years when he was kind of down and out. No one would say Brian was not hardworking, which kind of brings us to the next phase of this was like, so Surfin' is this sort of regional hit. How do they become nationals, how they become rock stars? And this is the first success, really. 1962 and 63 is when they break through big time, and the breakthrough song is Surfin' USA, which I'm sure you've all heard.
Again, another great song.
If everybody had an ocean across the USA, then everybody'd be surfing like California. A bushy, bushy blonde hairdo, surfing USA. You'll catch him surfing at
Nell, inside, outside USA,
Ventura County line,
inside, outside USA,
Santa Cruz and
Trinidad, inside, outside USA,
Australia, Caribbean,
inside, outside USA,
all over Manhattan,
inside, outside USA,
and down Tahiti Way,
inside, outside.
Everybody's gone surfing
USA.
Chuck Berry wrote that?
He indeed did write that.
Today I learned.
You did not know that. It's Sweet Little 16.
I know it's Chuck Berry's. I mean, but would they just give him credit for it?
Yes. So years later, they did give him credit for it. Yes. It was part of Chuck Berry noticed.
It's a Chuck Berry song. Yeah.
Here's the sort of strange concoction that the Beach Boys came up with is to take sort of the Chuck Berry beat, those trebly guitars we're talking with, and then the four freshmen and the harmonies and just all the vocal hooks. I mean, that song... It just jumps out of the speaker. And really, if you compare it to what we heard on Surfin',
I mean,
this is a quantum leap forward.
This is and it's roughly the same time period.
Yeah, it's maybe a few months later. Like 8-9 months later.
They had a professional engineer from...
Yeah, and I mean, that's interesting because that becomes a big issue. And that sort of, you know, kind of leads us to the next point, which is Brian did not like Capitol Studios.
He did not.
Did not want to record in Capitol Studios.
Like, which is funny because they were a lot of people loved it. I mean, a lot of people loved the old Capitol studio. They rearranged it in later years, but that's a different story. But a lot of people loved that studio, and that was like...
Murray comes in here and is like, okay, so we signed this deal, but we want to record at Western. We want to record at Gold Star. We don't want to just be stuck in the Capitol studio. And at this time, Brian is starting to become more interested in the recordings. He's really asserting full creative control over everything the Beach Boys do. And Murray is like, works a deal with Capitol, again, that no one had. which is you can use other studios. And the Capitol's like, okay, Murray, stop bugging us. You can take, you and Brian can go to different studios and start recording there, and it's fine. If you can keep giving us output like this, we'll live with it.
This is what is crazy to me. Brian's what, 22, 23 at this time?
Probably closer to, 21.
I mean, and he's the producer, which is like a thing.
Right.
You know, it's like,
especially in those days. I mean, the producers were the guys we've seen in the George Martin era with the Beatles. Those were the guys with the
you didn't go in the control room. Yeah, there was the suit
and the ties and the pocket protectors, and
there was a hierarchy. Like how Brian came to be able to, and I don't know, but it's critical in the story of the Beach Boys that Brian became the producer.
Right.
And he learned how to make the records that he wanted to make.
And make them sound the way he wanted to sound.
Yes.
And this is what blows my mind, too. You know, I'm sure we'll harp on this a lot. Like, how does he go from the producing of a tape in a garage to, like, a year later being like, I know what a producer is and I want to do that?
Yeah.
Where does that come from? And not only that
record sounds great.
Yeah. Oh, it does.
I mean,
it sounds fantastic.
Like, how did they do that? He probably had engineers. They probably had staff engineers, which is really, really important. He did have good engineers. I mean, Capitol's famous for like having, you know, quality recordings.
Really an amazing story. It's one of those sort of, again, one of those leaps that it happened. And not only, and as we go on, we'll see, not only does Brian become producer, he becomes one of the greatest producers in the history of music. I mean, let's just put that in there.
Yeah.
So rare for a pop artist to be producing his own stuff. 21-year-old kid, but around the same time, there's sort of another development in the mind of Brian Wilson, which he starts to become obsessed with two things: the song "Be My Baby" by the Ronettes, and that, of course, was produced by Phil Spector.
Yes,
and so Brian's learning how to become a producer, and very quickly he has an idol as a producer. His name is Phil Spector, and he's renowned for the Wall of Sound.
Right?
Can you describe what the wall? I mean, it sounds sort of obvious what it is.
You would have the same instrument doing the same thing over. You know, you'd have three guitars,
right?
You'd have a couple of drums that are and a timpani, or you'd have, in Brian's case, two accordion players. In, you know, later years, or two. You get multiple, and you record it, and it just makes a bigger sound. Today, you say you double track something,
right?
You put the guitar on, you know, on either side, and it just sounds fuller. And you get this bigger sound, and reverb is important to that when you know because it makes it sound bigger. Like there's not a lot of reverb on this particular one. You get that; it just makes it sound bigger.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think fuller.
When Brian gets obsessed with something, he gets very obsessed with a thing. And the story that Brian himself has put out there was that he was driving around in the car, and "Be My Baby" came on, and he had to pull off.
Yeah.
And sit there and listen to it, and his mind was just blown by this song. And "Be My Baby" would be a touchstone. Brian played it on his jukebox for years. He loved the song, but with Brian, it was like, not just, I love this song. We all go through this. This is a great song. He wanted to know how this song sounded the way it did.
Yeah.
And that's what led him to Phil Spector and sort of like, and he would go and, you know, the LA music industry was connect enough that Brian could sort of sit on some of Phil Spector sessions. Phil was a whole nother story, ornery guy. It's not like they had any sort of relationship, but Brian wanted to achieve something similar. And what we will see within another short period of time, he jumps way beyond anything Spector ever did.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll talk about this as we go on, but this is an amazing just sort of like musical intellectual development happening with Brian. We're still talking, it's 1962. This is 1963, right? The Beatles are just starting to be a big deal in Britain. And Brian is producing his own music. It's just fascinating. And the thing about these early years is like the output was insane.
Yes,
So you've got in 1963 alone, three albums, Surfing USA, Surfer Girl, and Little Deuce Coupe all reached the top 10 in 1963.
Crazy.
It's crazy. But as you point out, we've talked about before, like when we talk about, and this will become important a couple years later, when we say albums, like if you take an album, you listen to an album like Surfing USA. Surfing USA is the hit.
Surfing USA is the album.
This is the album. There's a couple other hits, and then there's a lot of filler.
A lot of,
you know, a couple of covers, and just
yeah,
just, you know, was it, and that was the way that was the industry. The singles were it.
Right, right.
You put an album out to sort of milk more sales on the single, and so you got to pad it out with stuff. And that was, you know, they were that was how they were so productive in those years. But the albums, as you will see, will improve over time.
If you go and you kind of try to listen to an album, it's not a pleasurable experience.
I mean, for example, I'm not sure which album this is on, one of the early albums in this era. Like there's a song about a root beer stand, for example. Yeah. I mean,
great
chug-a-lug. And so there's sort of like, you have there's a lot of throwaway kind of songs. They're okay. They're decent songs, but they're just like, no one's, Chug-a-Lug is not on Endless Summer. It's not on any of the great Beach Boys greatest hits, but it's not that far off from Surfing USA.
Yeah,
really.
But it's like,
and another thing to keep in mind during this period is, so Brian is still going on, is still touring. So the touring is starting to happen, a lot of touring with the band. And we can excuse Brian for writing a couple filler songs like Chug-a-Lug, because not only was he writing and producing all the Beach Boys music, also on tour, he was writing and producing for several other acts at the same time. And Brian's first number one single is Surf City, which he gives to Jan and Dean. And so
Murray thought, oh, that's really good, son. I'm glad you did.
Murray was incandescent with rage over this, as you can imagine. But Brian is, you know, this is a part of the Brian Wilson story. Brian was a kind of a generous, kind-hearted soul. If there's one thing you could say about him over the years, he kind of wore his heart on his sleeve, and he didn't see any issue with giving Jan and Dean. He was happy. He's on Surf City. Yeah. Brian Wilson is a falsetto on Surf City.
Right.
So not only is he handing them the first number one surf single when he's trying to be a surf band,
the golden ticket.
And he loved Jan and Dean. He was sort of like, he kind of idolized them a little bit. I mean, they came out a little bit before the Beach Boys, but I mean, honestly, for all Jan and Dean did, what do you associate with Surf City is the only thing that comes to mind.
I mean, there's not a lot
there.
What
I think about it. So, so that's fascinating. I mean, Brian was just incredibly productive. And also in this time, and you know, we all know the song Little Deuce Coupe, which is a sort of when the Beach Boys started moving from just surfing stuff to also car music, which was a step up, because they're going to talk about cars, because this is also part of the youth culture of Southern California. And in fact, Brian had hooked up with, and we'll see this as we go through the period, that Brian didn't usually write lyrics, certainly not in this earlier period.
Right, right.
He would have a collaborator. In many cases, that was Mike Love. But it wasn't even
always
in these early days. It wasn't,
right.
As Mike might claim, it was always him. But in the early years, Brian had other collaborators. I think the guy's name is Dickinson or Richardson. I'm not sure exactly. But there was a DJ who knew a lot about cars that wrote a lot of these car songs, the lyrics for Brian, including Little Deuce Coupe.
I don't think Brian had a driver's license.
I don't know that Brian was like, you know, cruising down that, wouldn't know any of that lingo about whatever, four on the floor and the 409 and really? this whatever. That was not Brian's scene. But the Little Deuce Coupe album is kind of interesting. It's an interesting listen, compared to some of the other ones we talked about, because it is kind of like some people have said it's a concept album.
It is, man.
And the concept is songs about cars. So from a strictly speaking standpoint, it is a thematic album, but it does not belong in the pantheon of great concept albums later on. But it's interesting. Listen, I think it hangs together better than some of the other ones. Yeah.
So I mean, anyway, this is where we have some really cringy lyrics, like just bad.
Oh, for sure. I mean,
like, this is why the Beach Boys kind of got there. You know, like, be true to your school is just,
yeah.
Oof.
Well, really? I mean, it's early 60s teen culture, and it's written by, you know, some of it was written by older dudes too. Yeah. You know, so it's a bit of a stereotype, and there's a lot of you know, this is a word the Gen Z likes a lot, but cringe lyrics will be something that we hear a lot from the Beach Boys, not just Brian, the other Beach Boys as the year go on.
They're really good at it.
I think the last song we wanted to play during this period is actually an example of where Brian is starting to branch out from the kind of, you know, the bouncy surf songs, the muscle car songs, to a song like Surfer Girl, which is a very different vibe.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you got the title Surfer Girl, which was sort of hit. But if you listen to the song, here's what's amazing about Brian that he could do is somehow, even though it's Surfer Girl, it conjures emotions inside of you. He could, like, somehow, and some people have this gift, and it's incredibly rare, had the gift to, like, get inside of people. You don't know where it comes from, but you're listening to it and you're like, good night, this is fantastic. I mean that's for me. I mean, even though it's Do You Love Me, Surfer Girl, just the tone, the way the things are arranged, the instrumentation, everything he did worked. Like, how he could do this. I mean, again, not every song, but it is staggering when you look through all of this and you look at all the really, really great songs. And this, to my view, this is one of my favorites. So. I mean, come on.
Like, I know. I'm
when those harmonies kick in, I mean, how can you not have some sort of emotive? I mean, I don't know. I do. I think it's brilliant.
I'm really glad you brought up the emotionality of the music, because I think that is something that carries through.
That's why we still listen to it.
Because and that's why the goofy lyrics don't really matter that much. The emotive power of the music, the harmonies, the melodies, the counterpoints, it affects you in a way that you can't. It's really difficult
but
to
it does
intellectualize
touch, but it does
about
touch on the eternal thing, am I loved?
Yeah.
Right?
Which I think is the story of Brian's whole life.
I mean, it really is. I mean, whether he was thinking about it or not, but it's like what the music emotes is, am I loved?
This is why, you know, for all those Midwestern kids who'd never seen a beach or a surfboard, what mattered here.
That's not what mattered.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's like, it's great to think about going to California and, of course, became a beacon and people moved there and all that. But the songs are still listened to because the emotions are so real. Like, he was the producer and he was learning how to put these records together. And he got really great at it incredibly quickly. Like, the vocal arrangement is amazing. Like, I mean, how he did it and how he did it. It's not that he did it once. Is he did it over and over and over and over. And it's one of those things. It's like, we were talking about this earlier. It's like, there was a Beach Boys formula. Yes, the songs are all kind of about the same thing. But
he always somehow made them unique. Like, you know, there's other songs of this vein, the sort of really introspective Beach Boys song, which is probably why we talk about them as much as we do. It's not really Little Deuce Coupe and 409. I don't think that's exactly what brings us back to them. I mean, don't get me wrong. If you enjoy that, fantastic. But it's really In My Room, Surfer Girl, We'll Come to It, Don't Worry Baby.
Yeah.
All these songs that are just like that, something, somebody special like Brian could do. I mean, Jan and Dean could not do these songs.
Right.
Right. Very few bands could do these songs. Brian was unique in this. And
right. I mean, there's, yeah. And even to try to put yourself back in the mind of that era and imagine like when, even what else was coming through the radio.
Even if you heard it today.
Well, that's, yeah.
If I heard it today, I mean, if I had never heard that song and it came on, I think I would have the same reaction to it.
I think there's 100% documented evidence that that's true. And that fast forwarding into the story, when they put out a greatest hits compilation in 1974 called Endless Summer, a whole new generation.
Yeah.
We're like, into these songs immediately.
Yes.
Immediately. And that was not the experience of people who were 10 years old in 1974.
It didn't become a hit because only a certain select few people listened to it.
Right.
It became a hit because the society at large.
It's a universality
went back to it.
All right. And that is where part one of the Beach Boys Week will come to an end. Thanks again, Mike and Nick, very, very much. Interesting look at the early days of the Beach Boys there. And I was spending a little time looking through my collection of books. And if you want to read a little bit more about the early days of the Beach Boys, there are a couple I can recommend. One is a book by Timothy White, and it's called The Nearest Faraway Place, subtitled Brian Wilson, The Beach Boys, and the Southern California Experience. This book talks a lot about Brian's ancestors, his grandfather, how they got from Kansas out to California. And it also goes into a lot of detail about the Southern California teen culture of the time, with cars and surfing, and talks a lot about how Dennis got into it, and has details on how the Wilson brothers interacted and got on at school. And I find that background to be really interesting personally. And it definitely puts in perspective of California and what made it seem so appealing and so interesting to the outsider. Another one is a book called God Only Knows, The Story of Brian Wilson, The Beach Boys, and the California Myth by a writer called David Leaf. It's got some very good information in it, too. And finally, David Marks, one of the founding members of the Beach Boys and left the group, I don't think by his own choice, has written a book, and it's called The Lost Beach Boy, The True Story of David Marks, one of the founding members of the Beach Boys. He has an assistant writer on this book. David does, a ghostwriter, if you will. And I haven't read this book, but obviously from the title and coming from his perspective, since he really was around the group, mainly in the early part of its existence, that would probably have some really good information, too. Interesting stuff. Just a little book add on there to the early days of the Beach Boys. With that, we're going to close out today's episode. We'll go out with an early Beach Boys tune, since it's been mentioned in the episode. There it is. Thank you very much. And everybody, get ready for tomorrow, when we will have the second part of Beach Boys Week. We will talk to you guys then.
Here a mug, there a mug, everybody chug a lug. Here a mug, there a mug, everybody chug a lug. Gary likes a girl's tight black pants. Larry knows he doesn't stand a chance. Carl says hurry up and order quick. Dave gets out to chase that chick. Dennis wonders what's under the hood. A big chrome tag and it sounds real good. But I go down to the root beer stand to drink up all that I can.
Give me some root beer.
You and Brian can go to different studios and start recording there, and it's fine. If you can keep giving us output like this, we'll live with it.
This is what is crazy.